Good afternoon. We're going to hear argument now in the case of Hawkins against Sevier. Mr. Heckman.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Michael Heckman for petitioner appellant John Hawkins L. As punishment for a physical altercation with a correctional officer, the state deprived Mr. Hawkins L. of 6,838 days, or nearly 19 years, of good time credits. Apparently the longest such deprivation ever imposed, and 12 years longer than the analogous maximum criminal sentence he could have received for the same conduct. Hawkins L. petitioned for federal habeas relief on the grounds.
Counsel, where do you get that figure? It was longer than the maximum criminal punishment. It was longer than the maximum punishment for the crime of which he was in fact charged, but Indiana has much higher ranks of assault and battery charges that would have allowed punishment, as I read it, for up to 32 years. He could have been charged with those offenses, but the prosecutor elected not to.
So the maximum sentence number comes from, as you say, the analogous crime.
Not the analogous crime. It was the crime with which he was actually charged.
The crime with which he was charged, not the crime that he pleaded guilty to, but the crime with which he was charged was assault on a public officer resulting in bodily injury. So it's the same elements as the disciplinary offense that he was found guilty of here. That's where the analogy comes in, that the elements are, you know, exact, and not just similar, but exactly overlapping in that regard. So Hawkins L. petitioned for habeas relief on the ground that his sentence was grossly disproportionate to his offense in violation of the Eighth Amendment, and that it was imposed without necessary evidence in violation of due process. Even though he fully developed these arguments in his briefing, the district court ignored them, found that the Eighth Amendment argument had been waived, and said nothing whatsoever about the some evidence argument. That error alone merits remand in this case. Because the sentence did violate both constitutional provisions, Mr. Hawkins L. Deserves a new hearing consistent with constitutional limitations, or to have that sentence vacated entirely. I welcome the court's questions. Otherwise, I'll move on to the waiver issue. The baseline question on waiver is, did the court exercise its discretion to reconstrue the brief in support as an amended petition? And if so, was that exercise an abuse or not? The state acknowledged below and doesn't appear to contend otherwise here that the document was not intended or styled as an amended petition. It was a brief in support of the previously filed petition. And so the question is, could the district court ignore that and reconstrue it as something else? As discussed in the briefs, we think there's no evidence that the court did so in this case. And as we know, an exercise of discretion requires an exercise of discretion. Here, there was an error in understanding, and that does not warrant this court's deference to the district court.
When I read his brief, the brief that he filed in the district court in support of the petition, it seemed to me, Mr. Heckman, that it actually became pretty clear that the brief was a brief and it was not an amended petition, because there are all kinds of references in it to the original petition that way, with arguments being, you know, expanded upon and what have you. So there seemed to be a lot of confusion over this, but when I read it, I thought it's pretty clear it's definitely not intended to fully supersede what was filed before, because it'd just be inconsistent with what he wrote.
We agree entirely. And you know, as the Supreme Court has recently reminded us, counsel's choice to file a particular kind of document to make particular kinds of arguments should be respected by the court.
Maybe the district court expected an altogether new superseding petition where the prior one was going to be stricken, but it just didn't play out that way.
We completely agree. And if the district court was unhappy with the document that it got, a follow-up order could have been appropriate, a decision to strike the brief in support and ask counsel to file an amended petition at that point could have been appropriate, but none of that happened here. And at base, as you said, the district court at least should have acknowledged that whatever this document was, it was intended to supplement and not to entirely replace. So even if the court had some discretion to construe this brief in support as an amended petition, it did not have discretion to construe it as a superseding petition in the face of clear indications of the document that it was not intended to do so. Turning to the Eighth Amendment, a few points to stress on this front. So I think, you know, we start with the inference of gross disproportionality. That's the first inquiry before we get to the comparisons to other state decisions. Here, looking at how do we reach that inference, this court and the Supreme Court have instructed that we look first to the facts of the case, how the actual offense compares to the sanction, and then we place that in the broader schema of the state's system. So here, as discussed, you know, this was an assault. Assault is serious, but assault is less serious than some offenses, as the Supreme Court reminded us in Graham v. Florida. And the motive here, responding to an abusive officer, which, you know, the state hasn't, you know, protested that description, at least that understanding from Hawkinsville's perspective of what was going on, that motive should be considered. And that's, you know, the court said in Solem, that motive matters in that context. And all of that needs to be placed in the broader schema of the state's disciplinary system here. And
before you get too far along into the facts, if I understand your brief right, you're of the view that the Supreme Court announced that three-prong test in Solem applies here?
That's right.
Have other federal courts, other circuit courts applied Solem in this kind of disciplinary context, and specifically with respect to the revocation of good time credits?
Certainly. It's not common because most revocations of good time credits are very short, and so this doesn't tend to come up. But no, for example,
forget about good time credits. Suppose somebody is released on parole back in the days when there was parole at one-third of the sentence, and a year later parole is revoked because somebody attacked and committed battery. Has any court held there that a cruel and unusual punishments analysis would apply if that means he has to spend 40 more years in prison?
So I'm not aware of courts having addressed the issue on either side. I will say this court and other courts have applied.
Parole has been around pretty much as long as we've had a country. And parole has been revoked for essentially any crime for the whole time it's been around. The absence of any holding that creates an Eighth Amendment problem is, well, it's glaring, is it not?
I don't agree. And so to begin with, this court has said the Eighth Amendment applies in the context of parole. It has not considered a proportionality question, to my knowledge, but it has considered parole procedures in terms of whether there must be a hearing before parole is revoked or after these questions. So it has applied the Eighth Amendment, and that's consistent with the Supreme Court's guidance.
Whether there's a hearing is a statutory or maybe a due process question, not a cruel and unusual punishments question.
What I can tell you is that this court has looked at it, and other courts, I believe, as well, have looked at the question through the lens of the Eighth Amendment. That's consistent with the court's discussion, A, in Austin v. United States, that the Eighth Amendment applies to punishments. Anything properly construed as a punishment receives Eighth Amendment scrutiny. And also the more on-point analysis in Solem, where the state's argument was, well, okay, a term of years is a punishment, but it's not really what the Eighth Amendment was meant to apply to. The Supreme Court said, no, the Eighth Amendment applies to lesser punishments, excessive fines, et cetera, yeah, and the greater
punishments. I don't have any doubt that there are stacks and stacks of cases where Solem applies to criminal sentencing. I'm not seeing it with respect to parole, supervised release, you know, disciplinary punishment in prison. That's where I'm having a harder time seeing its application.
Certainly. So to get back to your question, one Third Circuit case that is considered good time credits through the lens of Solem, through the Eighth Amendment, is Jackson v. Snezek, 342 Federal Appendix 833. There are a few others as well. As I said, they are rare. This court, stepping away from good time credits, has applied the Eighth Amendment to many, many different prison disciplinary punishments. So there's no broad question of whether the Eighth Amendment applies here under this court's precedence. And so I would direct this court to the discussion in Solem, that a punishment falling somewhere in the middle is not exempt from Eighth Amendment scrutiny unless there's affirmative indications in the Eighth Amendment text and history that it would be so exempt. And here, there's none of that. And so the default assumption is it is a punishment. This court must ask, is it a cruel and unusual punishment? Stepping over to the due process issues, there are two different ways in which this sanction violated the sum evidence requirement, the requirement announced in Hill. The first is the failure to include photographs or other documentation. And this is a requirement that the state imposed but did not satisfy. The second is the failure to include any evidence, point to any evidence of extreme pain, of the serious bodily injury that the hearing officer found. On the latter first, I think this is a kind of standard arbitrariness review. The Supreme Court in Wolf and in Hill has emphasized that all federal courts in review of state good time credit deprivations are looking for is that the decision was not arbitrary. In order to determine whether a decision is arbitrary, you look to the actual decision made, not to what decision might have been made, not to a theoretically different decision that could have been reached on the same facts. This is the same principle that has, you know, long applied, for example, in the agency review context in Chenery, and in other contexts as well, immigration, various other federal statutes. And so here, the hearing officer said there has been a serious bodily injury, and specifically one involving extreme pain. There is not some evidence in the record to support that. This is an issue that has been examined at times by the district courts. So, for example, in Boykins.
Hold on, Mr. Heckman. Why isn't that just a fair inference from what is in the report of conduct that underlies the disciplinary report? You're right. If you do a word search on extreme pain, you're not going to find that formulation in the report of conduct. But to read the report of conduct, if you gave it to the first person you saw on the sidewalk when you left the court today, they would say, I bet that guy was in a lot of pain.
I think there needs to be more. And so the district court in Boykins looked at a photograph where the officer had blood pouring down his face and said, that's evidence of some pain, but it's not extreme pain. And the key here is that extreme pain need be interpreted in light of the other definitions of serious bodily injury. Loss of a fetus, a substantial risk of death, permanent disablement of a limb. That's the kind of pain we're looking at here, pain that would be analogous to the damage done in those contexts. That's what needed to be evidenced here and was not. You're right that the conduct report didn't need to say extreme pain, but it needed to point to it in some way, and that was absent here. Unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Certainly, Mr. Heckman. Mr. Hunter.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court for three reasons. One, Hawkinsell forfeited his claims in the district court. Two, there is some evidence of bodily injury to support the sanction. And three, requiring Hawkinsell to serve more or all of his legal sentence for murder does not violate the Eighth Amendment. Here, in order to impose the sanction under the state policy, the state was required to show bodily injury. And here, the conduct report alone shows at least five instances that could be construed as bodily injury. Here, Hawkinsell hit Sergeant Betzner in the head at least three times, causing him to see double, causing him to bleed so much from his eye that it obscured his vision. He then pushed him back into the wall, injuring his shoulder. His shoulder was so injured that he couldn't do things with that arm in the rest of the engagement and the rest of the attack. Officer Betzner characterized his injuries as severe, and then he was also taken for outside treatment for his injuries. Those show bodily injury, and even those show extreme or a severe bodily injury. And so there there is evidence to support that sanction of removing all his credit time. On to the question of gross disproportionality. This neither this court nor the Supreme Court has ever applied the gross disproportionality to the revocation of credit time, and it's inappropriate to do so here. The credit time was that was removed merely required Hawkins L. to serve more or all of his sentence for murder. And there's no requirement to apply the gross disproportionality to that sentence, which was already found to be legal. Above all, this policy itself is reasonable. For prisoners that accrue a large amount of credit time, like Hawkins L., this requires that they face the prospect of being released from their legal sentence, in this case, almost two decades early. And it's reasonable for the state to require them to show rehabilitation. And here, instead of allowing them to go out nearly two decades before their sentence is up, in the instance when a prisoner attacks a guard and severely injures them, it's reasonable for them to remove that credit time and require him to serve the remainder of his sentence. Just like Judge Easterbrook said, parole has regularly done this. There has been no Eighth Amendment gross disproportionality that has been applied to that. And here, Hawkins L. was not going to stop until he was made to stop. And it's not reasonable to require the state to wait until somebody is killed again before they require them to serve their full sentence for the murder that they committed in the first place. If there are no questions, the state asks that this court affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Heckman?
Just beginning on that last point, Mr. Hawkins Dell accrued nearly 19 years of good time credits over 23 years of sentence. He was not someone who needed to be stopped. He was a good prisoner who had been consistently respectful and obedient to the rules that had one bad day. In terms of that deprivation, 19 years, had the bodily injury not been found, it would have been at most 1 year. In the criminal analog, analogous sentence without bodily injury had a maximum of 2.5 years. With bodily injury, it was a maximum of 6 years. 2.5 to 6 years is the criminal jump that could have happened. Here, it was 1 year to 19. In terms of the parole question, I think the better analogy for parole is not deprivation of good time credits, it's segregation. And as the courts have explained, segregation in prison involves other considerations, the security of the prison body, the security of the population, administrative issues that don't go directly to punishment. And I think parole is similar, but there we're talking about the general public and not the prison population. That's the better analogy. And just as segregation gets, you know, less constitutional protection than good time credits, I think, you know, there's an argument that parole might as well. In terms of requiring Mr. Hawkins L. to serve all of his sentence, that is just simply not how the Supreme Court and this court look at it. Good time credits are an independent liberty interest. This is not something that the state can revoke at will once it's granted it. States are not required to offer good time credits, but once they do, those credits deserve the full protection of Wolf and Hill. That's what the court has held. Here, we have searched the Federal Register far and wide. We have looked through thousands and thousands of cases. We have not found any deprivation of good time credits that comes remotely close. No deprivation in the state of Indiana that comes close. No deprivation for analogous conduct nationwide that exceeds 6 years that we are able to find. It is rare for a sentence to violate the Eighth Amendment, as Solem and more recent cases have held. This is a rare case. We ask that this court remand this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Heckman, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept this court's appointment and your assistance to your client and to the court both. The case is taken under advisement and the court is in recess.